Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And in case you missed it here in Boston, this is day two of Carmageddon, the traffic apocalypse. We're talking, of course, about the partial shutdown of the Mass Pike and the rebuilding of the Commonwealth Avenue Bridge, which is taking place just blocks from our studio. This morning, Acting Highway Administrator Jonathan Gulliver said overall traffic levels are down about 20% on the Pike. People are finding other ways around it. And he's optimistic that the project will be complete on time in just a couple of weeks.
We've hit all our major milestones. We're expecting to hit all our upcoming major milestones. So we're pretty happy with progress right now.
So pretty happy with the progress. Now, for commuters, the road closures and detours have created delays and inconvenience, but they also reminded some of us of the pleasures of a car-free urban center. I've been biking to work this week, loving that the BU Bridge has been transformed from a life-threatening obstacle course to a peaceful oasis spanning the Charles River. It's a delight for bikers and pedestrians. Now, we understand that lots of drivers will be happy to have the bridge back. We need it. But it did make us wonder, why don't we have more car-free zones in and around Boston? And if we did, where would they be? What would they look like? And how would they transform both the city's landscape and our relationship to it? Well, to talk a little bit about that, joining me in the studio is Brian Reamer. He's the Associate Director of the New England University Transportation Center at MIT. Welcome back. Good to have
you. Thank
you. Yeah, thanks for joining us. And joining us by telephone is Randall O'Toole. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington, author of Gridlock, Why We're Stuck in Traffic and What to Do About It. And Randall O'Toole, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. Do you favor more car-free neighborhoods in the city? Some will point out that it works in Europe. Why not here? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Brian, I want to sort of acknowledge, first of all, there are some car-free zones in Boston, like Downtown Crossing, but is there an argument for more, for bigger, for sort of pursuing this agenda more aggressively?
Well, I think it's really a balancing question. And in and of itself, how do we balance our needs for vehicular traveler with that of the pedestrians and the cyclists? I'm a biker by nature, love riding, hate riding down Comm Ave in particular during commuting hours. So how do we begin to move traffic patterns around to allow more space for cyclists? And is the answer car-free, or is it really multi-use where the pedestrians have their zone, the cyclists have their zone, and the cars have their zone? And that's really been a model that's really taken off in Europe, where cycling to and from work is the norm in many cities.
Yeah. So give us an example of how that might work, or, you know, what you would like to see. I mean, are we talking about, I don't know, like Newbury Street, for example, that there's been that experiment, just keep it car free for good?
Well, that's one option. The other option that I really prefer is, how do we take the sidewalk and perhaps some of the shoulders, you see it today, you have the cars moving as they do in the center. You bring the parked cars next to them and use the parked cars as a protective barrier to the cyclists and the pedestrians who are sharing the sidewalk and their own walk streams.
Yeah. Well, what about the sort of European example? I'm thinking of historic centers in you know, obviously old cities over there, but Boston is an old city. Why not just shut down parts of the city to daily traffic?
Well, I think that that's a possibility as well, but we do have to begin to think about, where do the cars go, and how do we move around that zone, and how do we redefine the flow, the queuing effect that occurs as we enter intersections and move around that? How do we redefine that to allow for that car-free zone so that we don't end up with increased gridlock on the Mass Pike, Comm Ave, and every other intersection throughout the city?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And that's really doable, but it's going to take a long-term focus and shifting the vehicular traffic around differently. And Bostonians aren't known to be good and looking forward to change, and especially in traffic flow.
Right. Yeah, you could almost say we're famous for just the being just the other way. Listeners, we're talking about whether more car-free zones in the greater Boston area is an idea worth considering. What do you think? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Randall O'Toole, I'd love to get your perspective on this. You're author of a book called Gridlock, Why We're Stuck in Traffic and What to Do About It. Tell us your quick answer to the question. Can cities like Boston just shut down areas to traffic so that pedestrians and bicyclists can have a slightly better quality of life?
Well, roughly 100 cities across the United States have attempted to do so in the past, and roughly 90% of them have ended up reopening their cities, their streets to cars, because they essentially destroyed all the businesses because people couldn't get to them by car, and they weren't willing to walk more than a block or two to get to them on foot. So the businesses moved away. The few places where pedestrian-free or car-free zones have succeeded tended to be places where the pedestrians were already there in large numbers, such as universities or resort towns. And if you already have lots and lots of pedestrians and you have plenty of parking for people to park at that's near to the car-free zone, then you can close a street or two to cars and still get lots of business for local businesses and still get a thriving neighborhood.
So let me throw two examples. I don't know how well you know the Boston area, but I'm going to assume you know it well enough for this conversation. I mean, a neighborhood like, I don't know, downtown Boston, you know, there's lots of foot traffic, lots of people work down there. There's, you know, all kinds of businesses, financial businesses and so on and so forth. I mean, would that be an example of a downtown area that would do well with no traffic?
I don't think any downtown closures have worked very well. If you closed like one block of one street to cars, you might be able to make it work. But if you start closing more than a street or two and more than a block or two of those streets, then what's going to happen is people are going to respond. You know, people are responding to the closure of the highway right now in Boston. They're responding by changing their travel habits. If that highway were closed permanently, their job locations would move, their home locations would move, because they would want to avoid the congestion.
But let me ask you this. Here's what I'm really...
Too many streets and yeah. Businesses would move out of downtown.
And I hear that argument, but I'm really puzzled by this. When I was a kid, I was growing up in Europe, and I remember this debate happening in Italy in the 1970s. And the predictions were that downtown businesses, city center businesses, were going to all suffer when they started to close those historic centers of the cities across Europe. In this case, it was Italy. And those arguments were never borne out. In fact, the businesses thrive. They did better and better. So what's different over there than the model here? Brian, go ahead.
I think it's really the design of the cities in general, because if you think about a lot of the European cities, the dense downtown environments were really developed before the advent of the car. They were designed as pedestrian malls.
Yeah.
The cars came afterward. Here in cities such as Boston, New York, even the West Coast, San Francisco, LA, we're dealing with cities that really came along after the automotive revolution. So, you know, we can take cars out, as Randall said, of a block or two, but our demand for mobility and our connection to the vehicle as a convenient way from getting from point A point B really dominates. I think the broader question is, how do we develop more effective shared use environments where, you know, the pedestrians, the cyclists, and the vehicles all can coexist together in a much more conflict-free, stress-free environment?
Well, I want to get to some of your ideas for that, but we've got a lot of people wanting to get on this conversation. So let's take some calls. Josh is calling from East Ham. Josh, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Yeah, thank you. As somebody who has lived both in major metropolitan areas in the United States as well as Newcastle, England, the problem with having car-free zones is we're such an auto-focused culture compared to Europe. Somebody who bikes on the Cape out of necessity because of the traffic down here, the congestion is so bad. Whereas in Europe and Newcastle, England, they're not really that bothered with their autos. So they could care less. I know plenty of people over in England who don't even have a driver's license.
Right. Well, arguably, and Randall O'Toole, maybe you can chime in on this. Isn't that changing? I mean, there does seem to be a sense, particularly among younger Americans, millennials, where there is less interest in cars. Does that portend a sort of kind of change as we go forward and maybe a more openness to car-free zones?
Well, the millennials were maturing just as we had the big financial crisis. And as we recover from that crisis, they're going out and buying cars just like everybody else. Driving is surging upwards now much faster than the population. So per capita driving is increasing. And, you know, when we compare the United States with Europe, we have to remember two things. One is that in Europe, gas taxes, fuel taxes are $4 to $6 a gallon, and that suppresses driving. But the other thing is, even with those high fuel taxes, Europeans drive far more than they do any other form of travel. They drive far more than they use transit or intercity trains or planes or anything else. We drive for about 85% of our travel in the United States. Europeans drive for about 78%. It's less total miles because they drive about 10,000 miles per capita per year, and we drive about 15,000 miles, or rather, we travel 15,000 miles per capita per year. So we do travel more. That's because of our lower fuel prices.
Sure. Interesting. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Medford. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to say I really appreciate the thought of just looking after people and bikes, not just cars, and the design of things. I've been to L.A., where they have main boulevards that are closed off to road traffic, but foot traffic gets to flow through there, and the shops really feel the benefit of that because people are much more likely to take a minute and see into a shop, look into it, walk into it, you know, if they can actually get there and they're not having to park and they're not having to stop. I'd like to see more of it.
All right. There's Alex from Medford. I'd like to see more of that here in Boston. Brian, you were talking about things that we could do to essentially improve the possibility of coexistence of cars and pedestrian cars and bicycles. It seems like we're seeing some evidence of that around the city. I'd argue not a lot of it, and it's not happening fast. But what more needs to be done to sort of speed it up?
Yeah, and I'd agree. We're seeing more and more of that around the city, and it is not happening fast enough, from downtown Boston and installation of some protected bike lanes to Brookline doing the same thing. I think European cities in general, the ones that are most friendly to pedestrians and cyclists, have really adopted broad multi-use design. The cars are traveling in the roadway, separated from the park car by the parked cars from the pedestrians and the bicyclists. Here in Boston, we have a tendency to run bike lanes next to the moving traffic, where we're all worried about the car door opening or a motorist on our left swerving right. So it's really protecting the cyclists, putting the cyclists and the pedestrians that are moving at a relatively more consistent speed, separating them from the traffic flow, to encourage the use of alternate forms of transportation. Now, that's both transit, areas we need to improve here in the city as well as walking and cycling.
Hmm. What about, is there an argument, Randall O'Toole, I'll come to you for this. I mean, I'm just curious about this, for sort of forcing the issue. In other words, the way people live and the way people would choose to get around might well be dictated by the way the roads exist. As you mentioned, Commonwealth Avenue is closed down. The Mass Pike is closed down today. People have found another way to get around. So if there were laws and policies that essentially protected urban centers, wouldn't people just adapt? And in the long run, wouldn't that be better for the urban centers?
Well, the way they would adapt is they would move their jobs away from Boston. They would move their homes away from Boston. They would avoid places where they couldn't get around.
Oh, I see.
And so that's not a good policy if you want to maintain economic viability. You know, if you don't mind poverty as a result, then that might be okay. Just last week I was visiting a city that I think has probably the highest amount of pedestrianism on one particular street of any city in the United States. They have tens of thousands of pedestrians going up and down the sidewalks of this street all day long. And they do it despite the fact that the weather there gets up to be 108 and 110 degrees. And I'm thinking of Las Vegas, and in particular the Las Vegas Strip. Now, the Las Vegas Strip is a street that is 10 lanes wide for automobiles. And the street has sidewalks on both sides with pedestrian overpasses on all major intersections. And so you get this huge amount of pedestrianism because we've separated the pedestrian somewhat from the cars. Personally, I'm a cyclist. I cycled up and down the Las Vegas Strip and other streets there, but most people don't bicycle, but they do walk a lot in the heat. And I think You know, what Brian is saying is true. It's not a measure of closing the streets to cars. It's a matter of making the streets accommodate both cars and pedestrians and hopefully bicyclists safely.
Well, let me introduce Vineet Gupta. He's a director of policy and planning for the Boston Transportation Department, and he oversees the city's initiative Go Boston 2030. And welcome to Radio Boston, Vineet Gupta. Good to have you.
Happy to join you.
So you've been listening to this conversation. Give us a quick sort of rundown. What are Boston's plans for car-free areas or with regard to what Brian and Randall have been talking about, ways in which roads can be made more accommodating to cars and people?
Sure. Well, let's start with an example that's been around for, I guess, several decades now, downtown crossing. And it's seen various levels of success over the years. And in recent years, there's been a resurgence of more and more use by pedestrians. There's activity on the street. There is more option for shopping. There are more residents living in the area. So the question to ask is, how has it made a resurgence? And I think that there are two major ingredients that might apply to other situations as well throughout Boston or in other cities. One is that we need activity on the street, whether it's vendors, whether it's people performing, whether you can do a free yoga class like you can do out in downtown crossing today. That's one. Two, you really need partnerships with the people who live there, people who have small businesses there, people who go to work there. And in this case, in downtown crossing, we have the downtown bid. And they've done a really good job in partnership with the city of Boston to work with all the abutters, work with people who are dependent on the downtown crossing area to make it a success.
So, Vineet, are there other parts of the city that might be suitable for that kind of model, that kind of downtown crossing type car-free model?
I think there are opportunities for sure. And one example, or two examples that I can talk about, one is Newbury Street, where, as you know, we have been experimenting at this stage with closing the street on a weekend morning, pretty much. And again, it's been a huge success. The other is Canal Street, mm-hmm. In the Bulfinch Triangle area near North Station, where we again did what we call an open street, but limiting it to pedestrians. The point here is that you can't flick a switch and make an area pedestrianized all the time, kind of at once. It has to be phased in. People have to get used to it. So you start maybe on a weekend morning, and if it's a success, maybe do that more often. So you really have to kind of phase things in.
I get it.
You can't do them overnight.
Vineet Gupta, stand by because we've got a couple more calls. I'd love to have you on the line for them as well. Sam is calling from Somerville. Sam, good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you. We're talking about cars as though they're this foregone conclusion that everybody needs, but they're also destroying our planet, and I don't really see how we can have this conversation without talking about climate change and privileging the forms of transportation that aren't contributing to it.
Yeah, it's a good point. Vineet Gupta, let me come to you as sort of the representative voice from the city of Boston. To what extent is climate change being considered in this conversation?
Well, you mentioned that the city has recently launched Go Boston 2030. We published the final plan in March. And as part of that plan, there are some goals that drive it. And those really have to do with reducing the use of motor vehicles in the city and increasing the use of transit, increasing opportunities for people to bike. All of that means that we will have less emissions and that would have a definitive impact on climate change.
Yeah. And Brian Reamer, I'd love to come with you, to come to you with that question as well. I mean, to what extent should this the climate change issue be driving this conversation?
Well, I think it all drives the conversation. I think congestion, climate change all blend together to some degree. And in really the modernization of an urban infrastructure, and that's transit, pedestrian zones, cyclists, vehicles coexisting. It's not that the car is going to go away. It's not that the car should go away. Maybe different powertrains make more sense. But how do we begin to really modernize our infrastructure over the course of time? As Vineet said, you can't flick a switch overnight. Money here doesn't grow on trees. It's going to take resources. It's going to take planning, and it takes long-term strategy.
We've got time for a couple more calls. Let's go to Joel, who's calling from Hyannis and listening to us down there on the Cape. Joel, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, tell me what's on your mind.
A couple times throughout the summer in Hyannis, there's this program, Hyannis Open Streets, where they close down a portion of Main Street to vehicles. And it's a great time, actually. I mean, I spoke to a lot of the people who own businesses there, and there's a lot more traffic there because there's a lot more people walking. And in communities where this has happened, I've heard of an example in Curitiba in Brazil, where they closed down a section of the street, and at first the business owners were very opposed to it, but in a couple weeks they saw the increase in business from people and increased foot traffic, and it's been one of the most popular places in the city ever since.
Interesting, Joe. I'm glad you brought that up. Randall O'Toole, I sort of brought up that same argument a little while ago, but what's the secret sauce there? Because clearly it works in some parts of the world and in some cities. Vineet talked about agreements with local businesses, but when does foot traffic only, help businesses as opposed to driving folks away from businesses, as you suggested, also can happen?
Well, as I said, the pedestrianism works when there's already a lot of pedestrians.
I see.
And there's already a lot of pedestrians in Hyannis because it's a resort area, and there's already a lot of pedestrians in Curitiba because automobile ownership is only about half of what it is here. And so, it's going to work there better than it's going to work in an ordinary American city where we have 8 cars for every 10 people. And, we have tried for decades to reduce auto driving. People don't remember, but 50 years ago, our air was filthy. You couldn't see across from one end of the city to another because the air was so dirty. And so we did 2 things. We made cars cleaner, and we tried to get people out of their cars and on the transit and walking and bicycling. And we made the cars a lot cleaner. Today, the average new car produces only about 2 or 3% of the pollution of what a car did in 1970. On the other hand, our attempts to get people out of their cars failed miserably. We've ended up making our cities more congested, so we've actually made our cities more polluted than they were because cars pollute more in congestion. So if our goal is to reduce global emissions of CO2 or other greenhouse gases, then the way to do it is to make cars greener, not to try to reduce people's driving, because that doesn't work.
Interesting. Brian Reamer, a final thought from you.
I think the answer is people like to drive. People like personal mobility, and that's why services such as Uber and Lyft are doing so well in the States. But convenient, reliable public transportation does pull cars away from the road. And investing strategically in alternative forms of transportation is a wise choice for cities in the future.
All right. Well, we're going to leave the conversation there, but I want to thank Brian Reamer, Associate Director of the New England University Transportation Center at MIT. Brian, thanks for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Randall O'Toole at the Cato Institute, author of Gridlock, Why We're Stuck in Traffic and What to Do About It. Randall, thank you very much.
Happy to be here.
And Vineet Gupta, Director of Policy and Planning for the Boston Transportation Department. Vineet Gupta, thank you as well.
Thanks much.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, author Tom Perata on his new novel, Mrs. Fletcher. He's with us live in the studio. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.